Hey, this is Mike. So for the last few weeks, we've been discussing the documentary, The Folks Behind the Funnies. We talked about it so much that we are doing three episodes about it. This is the third one. So join us for a 40-minute special, a truncated episode of a special presentation, or Alf will not be seen tonight, where we discuss and conclude our discussion of The Folks Behind the Funnies.
Some of your favorite cartoon characters will help you understand how drugs and alcohol can ruin your life. So watch the program. Talk about it with your family.
Oh yeah. I will say I think Schultz understood his artistic limitations, so it's probably best that he did. All right, I'm just gonna do as little as possible, you know?
Yeah.
Because like I feel like if there are a lot of artists who are like, oh well, I'm gonna draw some black features, and it's like okay, but and then they just keep doing it. And it's like no, don't go that far. Do not. Because at a certain point, like, yeah, you're there, it become you kind of, you know, it can get problematic.
Yeah.
And a
Okay,
lot of.
I found the Dennis the Menace cartoon.
Okay, let me see this. Let me see the racist Dennis. Oh my God! Whoa!
Yeah.
Oh shit, I was not prepared. I was not prepared. Okay. it I was gonna say like I like how
Even
my
Dennis's dad
God
is like, "Holy shit.
yeah
Are
the
we allowed
dad
to
is like
print
oh my
that?"
God it's Michael J. Mushroom from the Enchanted Forest. Oh my God, what year is this from?
This is from what? Now, what year is this? This is from like 1965.
Ooh, okay, so this is post Franklin. Not good. I do remember Dennis the Menace, at least in the cartoon series, does have a black friend.
Yeah, a black friend that he has never actually introduced in
Yeah.
the never actually appeared in the strip.
That's right. He was only for Yeah, that's right, because the other kids, because Joey and Margaret are there, and Gina, I think, does appear in the comic strip eventually.
Yes, I like. Yes, we've seen that Gina is the girl that Dennis actually kind of likes, and he's not sure why. He's like, "Oh, chemistry? Ew, get my chemistry set."
Yeah. But the black kid has not appeared in the comic strip, and now maybe that's a good thing, because I feel like well, you know what? Oh my God. The joke is the joke is okay, the joke is not bad.
No, it's actually pretty funny. But then you put it in the
Yeah.
context of the other time this kid appeared. He redesigned him, and he's not that much better, honestly.
Okay, slightly better. Slightly
Yeah.
better. It looks like, you know, he's trying. There's efforts
Yeah.
being made.
Yeah.
And I get the joke. The joke is kind of amusing as well. I
Yes.
feel like, again, these are jokes that are these are from the 60s, and they're trying to grapple with a new world, you
Yeah.
know, a world where black people are just as good as white people in theory. And they're trying to kind of like, I feel like the point he's trying to make is, I feel like he's come. I don't know. You know what? I'm not gonna stop talking because I feel like whenever we talk about this stuff on this, I'm just waiting for the day that someone like clips me out of context and is like,
Yeah.
wow. It's like just a clip of me saying gollywog, you know?
Yeah. Well, that was
But
the word I
yeah.
was struggling for, and I ended up saying something worse, so.
Well, I mean, it's. I don't know that. I don't know that it. You know what? There's so many terrible words that. But yeah. Anyway, Anyway, Mort Walker, ladies and gentlemen. who else do we got in this thing? Who else do we got?
Oh, who's next. Oh, it's Dan Perraro, who, yes, the who created Bizarro. Oh, get it?
Oh, do you think he did that on purpose?
I'm sure he did. Yeah. And Dan Perraro looks like somebody that would read you his poetry on a date.
Yeah, he is. This guy is. This is the most hipster. He looks like the guy. Yeah, he looks like a guy who would write this comic strip, you know?
Yeah. Watching this special, I was surprised to find that, you know, although he immediately gives the impression of, oh, okay, this guy is the nonconformist. This guy is, he's one of my people. I found myself kind of disliking him.
He is, his actual, when he actually talks, even though he does seem kind of like, oh, he's the hip young nonconformist, his opinions are very kind of just like normie lib, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, he's like, really concerned about overpopulation.
Yeah, which I feel
who has to start having stop having babies, Dan? Who?
Yeah, exactly. Like, I feel like that's the sort of thing that, like, a lot of, like, kind of, you know, like, not necessarily, like, liberal sorts who don't think very deeply about stuff, they mm-hmm. can be very easily led into believing that overpopulation is the problem. And, you know, obviously, not, like you said, oh, who's overpopulating? Golly. it reminds me of when I was, like, in high school and they showed us this film about, I can't remember what class. It was some sort of environmental class, right?
Right, the squashed orange, I remember.
Oh, no, not the squashed orange, actually. oh my God, I love the squashed orange. Oh, that was a movie. No, this was a film we were learning about. It was about some environmental issues, and they talked about overpopulation, and they showed, like, okay, overpopulation is an issue, right? Well, let's examine a family of, like, three in America, right? And a family of eight in, like, Zimbabwe, right? And they're showing, like, okay, this family of eight, they live, you know, they live on a farm. They farm stuff. All their stuff is made out of wood that they grew themselves. They just, you know, they just live, you know, in a little village in the hinterlands. Mm-hmm. As opposed to these Americans who are, like, dumping, like, you know, like, garbage bags full of plastic into the ocean, like, daily. And at the end, they were like, all right, well, who's really overpopulated? Well, the answer is both. They're all both overpopulated. And I was like, wait, what are you talking about? That's not what I got out of this film. What I got out of it is overpopulation is not the issue. The issue is how much garbage you produce. And like a larger population could, in theory, produce less garbage and less environmental impact if they lived more sustainably. But we don't do that in America. And we produce more shit with less people. Or more damage with less people. But for some reason, this movie was very intent on saying, no, actually, overpopulation is still the issue, even though we just clearly demonstrated that it is not the issue. And I remember thinking, like, at the time, you know, being a young person and, like, you know, I was, like, 15 or something.
Yeah.
And so I watched that and I was like, well, I guess I must just not understand because I'm stupid and young. I guess overpopulation must be the issue and I don't get it. And it wasn't until later that I was like, no, actually, I was right.
Yeah.
They doesn't were just trying good? To like be racist.
Doesn't it feel good to be like, no, I was smarter than my teachers the whole time?
I mean, that's an experience that I have had a couple times in my life, you know? And it's always funny when you're an adult and you're like, wait a minute. I was right. I'm gonna call up Mrs. Eden right now.
And you know what else? It turns out you can catch more flies with vinegar than with honey. You just have to boil it down some.
Oh, damn. See, I don't know what to believe anymore. But anyway, Dan Pizarro, he's pretty, like, he definitely seems kind of very, very pleased with himself. You know?
I was going to say, very kind of self-important. Just sort of like, look at all these cute little things I hide in my comics. It's a game. Spend more time on my comic than other people's.
He's yeah, he always has that feel that like, are you really, do you really want to be in the newspaper? Wouldn't you be happier in like, you know, some, you know, an alternative zine, you know? I will say that like, I often get Bizarro mixed up with Non Sequitur, but Bizarro as a comic is way less full of itself than Non Sequitur, at least.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. And it's generally funnier. And, you know, Non Sequitur has all these recurring characters that aren't very good.
Oh, yeah. I know. It's like, oh, God. Okay. Oh, boy. We get to see this girl and her horse. Oh, good. We get to see what this diner lady. Oh,
yeah. The fisherman. Oh, boy.
The thing, Non Sequitur literally like 90% of Non Sequitur's jokes are like, did you know that lawyers are corrupt? Bet you didn't hear that one before. Whoa. You know, it's like literally like, okay, these are jokes you'd find in a greeting card, but like your art is like really detailed, so people seem to think that you're actually deep. Bizarro is not, the comic strip itself is actually pretty decent. I think it's actually one of the better ones, one of the better Far Side legacy strips, I guess.
Yeah.
But yeah, Dan Peraro as an interview subject is kind of insufferable. I do think it's funny. He's got like what, a retainer though.
He does. Yeah. He's like, he's got adult braces.
I mean, you know, that's nothing wrong with that, but it's just funny. Because no, again, it just makes it seem like, are you like trying to look more millennial? Is that why you're doing that?
It's like, so to our listeners who wear retainers or adult braces, it's okay. We see you. You're cool. You're not you're not trying to make yourself look cool on a special, a movie that didn't get released for 10 years.
So yeah, Dan Peraro. But after Dan, we get to the man himself, the man of the hour.
Mel Lazarus.
You know, a man, again, highly respected by his comics colleagues. And, well, I mean, I don't know. Is there anything else to say about Mel Lazarus? We kind of tore into him earlier, I guess.
Yeah, we kind of did. Yeah.
He's, you know, he does his thing. And, did he only do Miss Peach and Mama? I feel like there was more comics that he did.
There might have been another one, but not one that I can immediately remember. I'm just noticing right now that there's a space after between the apostrophe and the word mama. I was like, oh, great editing. Yeah, you really kicked this out the door without a second draft, didn't you?
Yeah. Well, they're like, look, all of these guys are dropping like flies. We better get this out fast.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Mel Lazarus. Yeah. Who else we got here? Oh, then we get Darby Connolly from Get Fuzzy.
Yeah, I couldn't have told you the name of the artist of Get Fuzzy. Get Fuzzy, you know, we've talked about how it's like Garfield done right in some ways.
Yeah.
It's basically the same thing. You know, a guy and his cat and dog.
I do really like Get Fuzzy. I think it's a really good strip. Very strong character voices in this one. I am shocked to find out that Darby Connolly does not look like the guy in Get Fuzzy, which I always assumed he would.
Honestly, he's kind of hunky. He's kind of reminds me of Billy from Power Rangers.
Yeah, I was thinking like when I saw him, I was like, oh, so this is where they got the template for the Chad Wojak, apparently. This guy is swole, and he's got these like incredible eyebrows, you know.
Yeah, he really looks like he should be wearing like a Letterman jacket, and you know, greeting you with "You got my homework, nerd."
Yeah, for real. Like, he's got kind of. I almost was like, he looks like
what? Oh my god, he's just
this,
man.
He is thick as a brick. This guy.
Yeah.
Just
he could be Bluto.
Yeah, man. And to think this guy, yeah, what's this guy doing drawing a comic? That's like for nerds.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's probably pays better than shaking down nerds for their lunch money.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I imagine that like when the cartoonists all get together, like, yeah, he's going to be in there and be like, all right, he probably doesn't even draw Get Fuzzy. He probably goes in and beats up the other nerds till they do it for him, you know?
All right, Scott Adams, you better. Oh, not you. Yuck.
You know, if I were to do a Midnight Pal style thing with cartoonists, like that would be the gag for Darby Conley. It's just he's just the mean jock who's beating up all the other nerds, of course, from the driest comic.
What's the comic strip Fire Police called?
What would it be called?
The Daily Flame? I don't know.
Yeah, there you go. Why not? Yeah, that works. So that is, let's see. So that's Darby Conley. Do we have anything else to say about him? I actually don't know, other than that he's a hunk.
Yeah, he's, he's got a comic strip that has lasted a good long time, and he's young, and he's very young compared to the rest of these. He's probably got some, you know, white in his hair by now, but
yeah,
I don't know. The next one I have absolutely nothing to say about. I have never heard of either of these comics.
Steve McGarry, he does Biographic and Badlands. I'm going to assume it's something in Britain because he's got a British accent.
Yeah.
I got nothing to say about him either.
Looks a little like Sting, but that's about it.
Yeah. Well, England. Let's see. Sting. Then, we got Brian Walker, who I assume is Mort Walker's kid.
Yes. I guess he took over for his dad on, High and Lois, because that's a Mort Walker joint too. You know, not everyone knows that Lois is. I'm pretty sure she's Beetle's sister. I might be wrong.
That's right. No, that's right. I remember that Beetle has visited on a couple occasions. Mm-hmm. It says that he is also a historian. I assume a comics historian.
Yeah, I mean, when you're surrounded by comics history like his dad, then it kind of comes naturally to you.
Yeah. And I will say that, like, obviously, he did inherit his dad's good looks, because he does look like his father's son.
He does.
You know, he's up there, but he still looks, like, really well held together. So, man, good genetics in that Walker family.
Yeah, he's got white hair, but his eyebrows are still a rich black, so.
God, well, we should all be so lucky, you know?
Yeah. I've never had visible eyebrows. I always say that I covet Travis's eyebrows, because he has eyebrows like Shin-Chan.
Well, I've never had that problem, because I have eyebrows. I look like a Mentak from Dune, so.
We forgot one of the female cartoonists. It's Bunny
we
Host.
We did. I can't believe we forgot Bunny Host, because Host? Hoost?
Host or Hoest?
Hoest?
Of all the hoes, she's the hoest.
Yeah, because wow, I did not realize who did the Lockhorns, and that was not what I expected at all. I believe her husband originally came up with the Lockhorns, and she took it over. But
she took it over, and then she outlived him, and then she brought her third husband on board to help her with the Lockhorns.
Wow. You know, she looks like the sort of person who would have, like, lots of husbands, you know?
Yes. She looks like she should be, like, swirling a wine glass and scoping you out to maybe be her next husband.
Yeah. She's like, she looks like, I don't know. Who's that comedian? The woman who's like, can we talk? Yeah, you know,
that one? Joan Rivers.
Like, Joan Rivers, that's it. She's very huge Joan Rivers energy here. Because she's got to be like 100 years old or something here, but damn, she looks good. She looks good.
She's not 100 years old here. I have no idea how old she was then, because she is 91 now.
Oh, okay. So she's
still with us. She outlived all these guys.
I actually was like, I thought like, she was actually a really interesting character in this documentary. I feel like she had, cause I'm going to be, uh, I, I'm being sexist here and ageist, but I remember, like, I think, like, some of the insights she had during this were actually kind of, you know, pretty sharp. And I wouldn't have expected, like, an old broad to, like, you know, especially does the lock horns to, like, have such, you know, nuanced perspectives on the field of cartooning.
Yeah. You know, it's, but, I mean, it's not sexist when you're admitting that you were wrong in the first place.
That's true. Yeah, that's right. In fact, if you think about it, actually, I'm the real hero here.
Well, you learned better. Something.
I learned something. But no, actually, I can't say that I am a fan of the Lockhorns. But I respect that she's kept at it. And she's also, I think she's actually kind of behind all the Parade comics. Like, I think
she's the creator of Laugh Parade and Howard Huge.
Man. So if you want a comic involving a big dog, you got your choice. There's Howard Huge. There's Marmaduke. I mean, I don't know which one is, you know, the, I don't know which one is a superior big dog comic, because
she also has one called Agatha Crumb. I'm not sure if I've heard of this one.
I've heard the name, but only when people are listing all the Parade magazine comics. I've never actually read it.
Well, it says here she's the Agatha Crumb is the elderly, eccentric, miserly owner of a cookie company.
Hmm. Interesting. Okay. That's a few things.
Yeah, that's certainly a premise.
Yeah, that seems like a lot. That's more than I would expect from a Parade, you know, comic, because you know, Lockhorns. It's a married couple. They hate each other. Howard Huge. He's a big dog. Agatha Crumb. Okay, miserly, eccentric, cookie millionaire.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, you know.
You've definitely got a lot more to meat to work with there. So, you know, maybe that was her white whale was, you know, I've always wanted to do Agatha Crumb and I do these really easy comics to finance it.
Yeah. Like that was the one where she, you know, she, that was the one where she had something to say.
Yep. It ran for 20 years. So maybe she said everything she wanted to say with it from 1977 to 1997.
I, having never read Agatha Crumb ever, you know, I can't say much about it, but now that I've clicked it, actually, this makes a little more sense because it looks like Agatha Crumb is not a single panel comic, which I believe Howard Huge and the Lockhorns are.
Yeah.
Cause I had assumed it was, which made the concept kind of hard to figure out. Cause like, how can you communicate all that in a single panel? But no, it seems to be an actual multi-panel strip. So you can probably do a lot more with the cookie millionaire premise.
Yeah. I don't know how you'd be able to make, you know, squeeze cookies into the premise of a single panel thing. But
yeah. Yeah. I do like, okay. So I just Googled, Agatha Crumb, and the first comic I'm seeing is Agatha speaking to some guy, and an underling, and she says, "I want you on a special assignment, Umland." And he's like, "I'm happy to be at your service, Ms. Crumb." And Ms. Crumb says, "You must take a brief loyalty oath. And after the loyalty oath, we perform a little ceremony. I hope you don't mind the sight of blood." So I'm like, okay, I like Agatha Crumb now.
Yes.
Considering it's, that she owes her wealth to Satan.
Yeah. I like that she's stroking Mad Cat this whole time, too.
Yeah. So I'm warming to Agatha Crumb pretty quickly. So so Bunny Hoist, good on you. I hope we'll have to do a closer reading of Agatha Crumb at some point. Let's see. I was hoping for a second that like maybe they had actually made
a movie of Agatha Crumb. No.
But no, it doesn't look like it. Okay. So let's see. Who else we got in this documentary?
Bill and Jeff Keane.
Well, we know the Keens.
Yep.
They're awful keen. They're keen.
Yep.
Yeah, so Bill Keane was still alive at this point.
Yes.
Again,
he was definitely getting on in years, and boy, is that a strong glasses prescription. Did you notice the way that it creates an illusion of a hole in his head?
Yeah, I did. I mean, he was, you know, this is Bill Keane, you know, the later years still going strong. Yeah. He's got Jeff there, his meathead son. Again,
yeah, yes, his large adult Jeffy.
Yeah, this is Bill Keane in his spin web years, I think.
Yeah,
after he swam the English Channel and then I just remember when he called spin web and spin web was like, this guy is gonna outlive all of us, because he's like,
yeah,
what is it? He does 100 push-ups every morning and But yeah, so Bill Keane, still around at this point. Family Circus, again, another comic strip that I'm not super fond of, but
I absolutely love Dysfunctional Family Circus. So if Family Circus led to that, then I am all for Family Circus. Actually, yeah, as a child, I briefly really loved Family Circus on an unironic level.
So, yeah,
I guess I went through a sort of sentimental phase.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing. I'll say this is I'm not a fan of Family Circus, but obviously it sets out to do a very specific thing and it does it very well. And for people who like that sort of thing, yeah, it's good. I'm basically saying I'm with Family Circus what everyone was in the documentary was saying about Kathy. You know, But I guess the best thing though, I will say, I feel like I really like the look of Bill Keane's earlier art. You know.
Yeah. Yeah. It was much more stylized to start with when he was just getting started, and the characters were much more, they had much more of that kind of Playboy cartoon look.
Yeah. I actually really like the way he drew Thel in the early years, where she's, I think she's actually kind of cute, you know, yeah, as opposed is. To she becomes more kind of gazelle-like over the years. So, I'm not a big fan of kind of where the style ultimately ended up, but it is fine. It's what it is. And I guess that's the end of, that's everyone in this documentary. So,
yeah. And at this point, okay, do we, oh my God, we've been doing this for 2.5 hours.
Well, you know, there's a lot of people in this documentary.
Yeah.
Now I'm trying to think if there's anything that have we missed anything?
Anything significant. Let's see. The story that who is this? We just gave ourselves a mnemonic to remember them all by, and now I don't remember which specific cartoonist it was who tells the story about going to the convention for the first time, where he. Oh, it was Jerry Scott. Yeah, Jerry Scott of Zits and Baby Blues tells the story about going to the grand ballroom for cocktails and him and his wife getting on the elevator and having the doors open and just having 500 great cartoonists and their spouses and families all gathered around, all in black tie, clinking their glasses and just being incredibly funny for nobody but each other. And he was like, and he told his wife, let's go downstairs and do that again. Cause they just had to watch the elevator open up on this world for them again. And I can understand that. I feel I would want to relive that moment as many times as I could.
Yeah, yeah. I can certainly see that. I think, because I think this documentary, what I find, one of the things I find kind of fascinating about it is, not so much a lot of the things that they say about their inspirations and what they do for, they're pretty much what you'd expect. Oh, right. Yes.
Yeah. The inspirations, we know exactly who every cartoonist says is their inspiration is either Crazy Cat or Pogo.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Always. I mean, it's like I think they when they become a syndicated cartoonist, they make you pick one of those two. Say, so, yeah, we get it, we get it. We all love that old drunk Walt Kelly, as we learned from Morbius.
Oh, hey, I guess that is the one black cartoonist featured here is Harriman, although because Harriman was probably actually. He didn't live as a black person, but his birth certificate listed him as quote unquote colored, and that he wore a hat all the time to hide his kinky hair.
Oh, interesting. I don't know that I knew that, or maybe you mentioned it before, but
he may have been a black person who, made the jump, which, I would hope that one day we will have a world where it's not, worth it to pretend to be white, but you can be yourself.
Well, I think the interesting thing about George Harriman then is obviously during the time he lived, it was probably necessary for him to pretend to be white to get a comic in the paper. And, and probably for his own safety and, career and many other reasons. I don't want to judge him for choosing to pass as white, because I'm sure there were lots of reasons that he had to do for that. But I do think it's interesting, because we talk about George Harriman all the time in comics. He's always brought up as like this, this great inspiration for so many cartoonists, and and like one of the godfathers of this business and this craft. And I have never heard anyone acknowledge that he's black, and I wonder, it's probably how widely known is it among even cartoonists?
I learned it from Scott Adams. He wrote about it in one of the Understanding Comics books. I don't know if it was in Understanding Comics or Reinventing Comics. Might have been either one.
Oh, wait. Scott Adams. Okay, sorry. I thought you meant
Scott Adams. No, Scott McCloud. I'm sorry.
McCloud. Okay. That's why I was so confused. I was like, really? The Dilbert guy? Of all people knew it?
No.
Anyway, sorry. Go on.
Got my Scots mixed up. Sorry, Scotland. I kind of apologize to Scott McCloud for getting his name wrong there.
Oh, he's fine. He's cool. I'm sure he'll be fine with it. So Scott McCloud. Interesting.
And, another cartoonist that I was kind of delighted to see acknowledged here is one who is kind of undersung, I think, is Sandra Boynton.
Now, I mostly know her as a book illustrator. I know she book draws like cats and cows
and greeting cards. But she is, she is a wonderful cartoonist in her own right. She has these, I've seen books illustrated by her, short stories and Cricket illustrated by her. Yeah. And she's a close personal friend of Weird Al. I don't know how that happened, but.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Huh. Yeah. She's one of those people she's everywhere and in everything. I mean, I feel like half of the books I read as a kid were illustrated by her.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, she's one of those people who becomes so ubiquitous, she kind of just is in the background, Like, you almost forget that she's a real person.
I found this board book by her that is really, really adorable with these funny-looking aliens. And it's just kind of a Sesame Street style thing where it's just like, how big are Blazorbians? So big. How small are Blazorbians? So small. And it goes through this for a few pages, and then you have like this lawyer standing looking confused on a planet. How lost is Steve? So lost.
Okay, that's pretty amusing. But I think she gets listed as one of Hillary Price's inspirations, I think.
Yeah, and once you see it, you're like, oh yeah, I can trace the DNA in her artwork.
Yeah. No, totally. I can definitely see it. Yeah, actually, makes you wonder, like, how many kids were inspired to go into cartooning or illustration by, you know, Susan Boynton, because she is in everything, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah, another person who is probably like that is J. Otto Siebold, who has spot illustrations everywhere, but most people probably know him best for his children's book, Olive the Other Reindeer.
Oh, right, right. I've definitely seen him around.
Yep. He did the illustrations for the original non-Tiny Toons version of Istanbul for They Might Be Giants.
And, oh.
Yeah. A lot of people don't know there wasn't one before the Tiny Toons version, but yes, it's significantly more surreal in their typical style.
Yeah, I mean, I would kind of expect that. All right. Let's see. Actually, so one of the things, but yeah, about this, I thought the documentary was kind of interesting. Kind of back to that thing about the ballroom, right?
Yeah.
Is, you know, so a lot of what is said is not particularly groundbreaking. It's all stuff you would kind of expect, and no one's dishing any interesting dirt. But no. I thought it was kind of interesting taken as a whole, because you're kind of getting the sense of the community of artists of this, of cartooning. And so recently, kind of to derail, Eve Harms, who is a very, very, very talented horror writer that everyone should check out, wrote a newsletter where she said some very nice things about Midnight Pals. So everyone should read that too.
That was lovely.
Yeah, yeah. I thought, and it actually made me think a little, because she was talking about Midnight Pals, but she was making a broader point about the idea of a community of artists, and the idea that, like, when you create art, you know, you're doing it by yourself to some degree, but you are always in conversation with, you know, a community of like-minded creators, but also, you know, a history. There's a history going back, and, you know, you're always, like, drawing off that, and you're always heir to a legacy, you know, that you might not really think about that much as you're creating. And, you know, in something that you create will obviously not last forever. You know, nothing does, but it will also kind of might influence people going forward. And, you know, and that's kind of how artistic legacies and traditions happen. And it was interesting seeing that in this, because you are seeing, like, the comics community, it's a fairly small community of artists, but you can see how they are kind of, they have this big respect for their fellow artists, and they can see the craft in each other's work, and they see themselves as heir to this legacy of, like, Pogo and Crazy Cat and Peanuts and all that. So
it would feel like, if I said it, it would feel like a tremendous overblowing of my ego, but, you know, if you are part of this industry, then it is something bigger than yourself, and it's been going on for 100 years. So, yeah, you do have a certain amount of duty to the art form. You know, as has often been remarked, the, you know, one of maybe three original American art forms.
Yeah, like, was it jazz and comic strips, I think, is the one they always say, right?
Jazz, comic strips, and graffiti, I think, were the ones.
Graffiti, oh, interesting. I hadn't thought about that, but that, yeah, that kind of scans. excuse me. But yeah, so it's easy to not, I think, like, any creative person, you know, is kind of, like, in that, because we're all influenced by what came before, and we're all, like, you know, trying to make something original, but also, you know, we're not born in vacuums. Clearly, like, you know, we take inspiration from stuff, and we make it our own. And so it was just kind of interesting to see, like, you know, how these people, you know, who are, how these artists really, like, interact in that way. And, that I think was, I don't even know if, like, it's It's hard to articulate, but there was kind of that vibe in this. So I just thought that was kind of fascinating to pick up on that. But in general, I don't think anyone said anything like earth shattering in this. It's like, things like how when Lynn Johnson is like, I don't know what I'm doing, but Kathy Jizizowitz said, I can just do this. So it's like, okay, you can see how artists helping each other out, you know, with their, back in the old days when we had you had schools, you know what I mean? Like, all the like impressionists are hanging out together in a cafe and talking about doing the latest thing. I guess nowadays we're like that, but in Discord servers.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, it's everyone has a particular campfire you gather around, you know, because, as has also been repeated multiple times, storytelling is a function of humanity. It's not just something that artists do. It's something, it's something that comes out of us as surely as burps.
Yeah. And that's why we should all keep doing it and burping and not let the AI do it.
Yes. Let's hear an AI burp. Come on.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it could generate the sound, but it wouldn't actually, forcing air out of something because.
No. And that, and then it's not the same thing at all. You know, it's like the drawing of the pipe. It's not a pipe.
Yeah. N'est-ce pas un belch.
Makes you think, actually. It's like, whoa, actually, that's pretty deep, I think. Man, I'm glad everyone's tuned in to hear our incredibly deep conversation about, I guess mostly we're slagging on Mel Lazarus.